At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Debbie from Vista. Welcome back. Come on. Come on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Absolutely. Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you. Thank you, Tom, for inviting me and everybody for making Joan and I feel welcome. Thank you for coming with me, Joan. Joan's a great friend and 62 years sober. She's my road dog. But you know what? I so appreciate all the people, the old timers at this meeting and people like Joan that have stayed sober and show by example, not just by what they say, but by what they do. And I thank you for that. So happy birthday to the two birthday people. That's really awesome. And I love what this facility does and all the people that they help. It just has such a cool feeling being in this room every time. I'm honored. I got sober June 1st, 1985. My home group's a Carlsbad Thursday night workshop. My sponsor's Sharon C. from L.A. And, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like it's the best thing that has happened in my life. And it's like, you know, I never felt a part of my whole life. I grew up in Ohio. I'm one of five kids, and my parents were good people, and I learned, you know, good discipline and a work ethic and how to keep a nice home and all that stuff. And I'm grateful for what my parents taught me, but it's like I never felt like I fit in my whole life, whether it was at family functions or neighborhood kids or whatever. And, you know, I started stealing my parents' beer when I was a little kid. And, you know, I got to be my dad's helper one Saturday morning. I wasn't sure what we were doing, but I loved being with him. And we were down in the basement, and he was working on the refrigerator, and I was handing him tools, and he was drilling a hole in the side of it. Well, he was putting a keg in. And so you got to love my dad. But anyway, I would help myself to that afterwards. You know, it's really handy having that little thing down there. Anyway, and so I started, you know, taking sips of their beer and that kind of stuff. And then when I was in junior high, I really started partying a lot. I found the neighborhood kids that I ran with, and we would get older siblings to buy us alcohol. And it was a little town in Ohio that we were from, and we would, you know, drive back and forth through the downtown and out into the park and then out in the country and watch the guys drag race cars, and we'd drink beer and smoke pot and throw up in the cornfields, you know. Anyway, it's like, keep coming back. We just, we had a good time, and it was like alcohol. I loved alcohol. What it did is it made me feel comfortable in my skin, and it was a solution to my problems. And it's like I sought that escape via the bottle ever since I was a little kid, and it just was, I was obsessed with it. And you know, a lot of bad things didn't happen to me in junior high and high school. I got pretty good grades. I fought all the time with my mom, and when I did my inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, my first one, it's like I realized that my mom and I fought so much because we were so much alike. And my mom was an alcoholic, and anyway, we fought like two cats in a paper bag, and I just couldn't wait to get away from her. And I would sneak out at night and cause her heartache and come sneaking back in and think that I made it, you know, because I didn't see any lights on. And I would round the corner and, you know, just where to step so the floor doesn't creak. And I was heading upstairs, and the living room was dark, and all of a sudden she'd take a drag off her cigarette in the dark, and I'm like, grounded again. Two more weeks ad infinitum. But anyway, I didn't care what consequences I had to pay to be able to go out and get drunk. And I did that often. And so I left at 18 to move to California, had some neighborhood three brothers that moved out here when their parents passed away. And I said I'd be out next year when I graduate high school. And I did. I had a high school friend that went with me, and Donna got homesick before we got out of Ohio. And I thought, it's my car. We're not going back. Anyway, and so she stayed a few months and then flew back. But, you know, I stayed, and I didn't feel like I fit in out here, and I didn't feel like I fit in back in Ohio. I didn't know I wasn't going to go back. I knew I had that gut-wrenching loneliness back there. And then I had it out here, too. I didn't realize that I brought the problem with me, that it was a spiritual malady and a soul sickness in me. And I thought it was circumstances. And, you know, I have three sisters and a brother, and they started all getting married and having kids and building big houses out in the country. And I would call home every week and speak to somebody. And I started comparing my insides to their outsides. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but I thought I was so lonely and so soul sick. And it sounded like they were so happy. And I thought, that's what the problem is I don't have him, and I don't have kids, and I don't have my own home, and I don't have Winnebago, and I don't have all these different things. And so I thought that that's what was missing. And not long after that, I got this. I started going to school to be a land surveyor, and I was working at an engineering firm as a draftsman, and I did that for a lot of years. And you know, what little self-esteem I got from my job, from getting pay raises and promotions, and I put everything into it because I loved what I did, and I could get lost in my work, and it would take me out of that self-centeredness, and that's why I loved it. It's like the worst hell that I go through any time, drunk or sober, is when I get locked in on self. And that's what I love about this program, is it's a design for living that works to relieve me of the bondage of self and to have a primary purpose, and that's to stay sober and help other alcoholics. And that's what so many people in this facility do, and that's why you see them all still here and happy. They have quality sobriety. They're not just miserable and white-knuckling their day. You know, they're joyful. And so anyway, and so you know, I just thought that the problem was, you know, I didn't have him, and I'm working really hard and I'm getting raises. And then I would go home and I would just think, all right, I'm not going to get drunk tonight. I'm just going to drink a couple. And I would drink until I passed out or ran out, and no matter what, it's like, and I meant those promises. I meant them to God. I meant them to myself. Whoever I was thinking I was talking to, I really didn't want to get drunk again. And it's like, and it happened over and over and over. And for a long time, my alcoholism didn't progress. And I was doing okay at work, and just my days were kind of blah, you know. And I met this neighbor gal, and she was a single mom. And when she didn't have her son, she would come and drink at my house when we got home from our jobs. And we were like the glum lot drinkers, you know. We were miserable. And she figured out, because she was so sharp, that the problem we had was that we didn't have a hobby. I said, well, that could be. And she goes, okay, so this weekend we're going deep sea fishing. And I go, okay, I'll give it a try. And so we went to the Oceanside Harbor, and we went there at like 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday to go on an open party boat. And we showed up with our coolers of beer. We didn't have fishing poles, you know, like whatever. We got our beer, you know. And so people were drinking beer on the docks at 5:30 in the morning. I thought, oh, my God, I am a fisherman. Who knew? I was like, Susan's pretty sharp, you know. And so we went on this party boat, and I just had a great time. And it's so funny because now, I mean, I've been sober 34 years, and I've been chartering boats for like 25 years for my coworkers. We go about 3-4 times a year, and so it's like, it's so amazing to me. They don't know my history, you know what I mean? But I know where I came from. But anyway, so we were on this boat, and we found these guys on there, and we, you know, that's really what we're trolling for, come to find out. But anyway, so I met this one guy, and he was a contractor, and he's a lot of fun, and he was unemployed, and he was a IV drug user, alcoholic, you know, catch of the day. Anyway, so took him home. It's like my little downfall. But anyway, I moved him in about a week and a half later, and that was so opposite of how I was raised and how I wanted to live myself, not just how my parents raised me, but I was out here on my own, and it was like, that was against my own beliefs, you know what I mean? And it was like, but doing my inventory, like I said, I found out that I was thinking that if I had him, then he would fix me. That's what was missing. If I had him in my life, somebody to have fun with, and he was a mess. And I started spiraling downhill because we started doing other things than alcohol, and I started calling in sick and being a mess, and he started working again, and his family said, you're so good for him. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's killing me. But anyway, I should have gone to Al-Anon. But anyway, he was still a wild, not come home at night kind of a guy, and it was just crazy making to me. And I would be up, you know, drinking till wee hours waiting for him and making those drunken phone calls trying to find him at jails and the hospitals and his ex-wife. That didn't go over so good. Anyway, and so, you know, all those phone calls that I made when I was drunk trying to find him and just absolute insanity. And then that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde life that I was living, then I would put on my dress and my heels and I'd go to the engineering firm and get there early and make coffee for the surveyors and start drafting. And I was just reeking of alcohol. And my one friend that was one of the surveyors, a good friend of mine, he came up and he goes, "You know what, Deb, you still smell like alcohol. You might want to brush your teeth again." And I did that, and I didn't realize it was just coming out my pores. It's like alcohol was my whole thing. It was how I coped with the anger and the sadness and the insanity of being with somebody that I couldn't trust, and it was how I cope with loneliness. And I would throw him out, and I got to where I'd be such a planner. I would stop at the Home Depot and get deadbolts, you know, when he wouldn't come home. And I would go to work the next day, and I'd get a deadbolt, and I'd go home, and I'd change out the locks, and then I'd sit there in the dark, and then I'd hear his van pull up, you know, wee hours, and I'd sit there and drink and smoke cigarettes, and it's like, and he'd try his key, and I'm like, I'd go, it didn't work, and I'd go to bed, and then I'd call him the next day, keep coming back, you know, and give him a key, and start that insanity all over again. And it was insanity, you know, and it was like, I moved him out for the last time, and during that time, my older sister called, and my mom's alcoholism had gotten really bad back in Ohio, and that they decided they were going to do an intervention, and I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had been going to this treatment center in Toledo every week for a while to prepare for this, and they asked me if I would come home and participate, and I said I would. I was so resentful at my mom, but I always wanted her sober. And it was, so they said I had to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I had to go home and spend a week without my mom knowing that I was there. I stayed at one of my sisters in the country and go to Toledo and spend all day at this treatment center catching up with what they did. And so I went to the only time I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous was from my doctor, because I was having chronic stomach problems because I was a daily puker. And I would throw up, and I would swear I wasn't going to drink that night, and then that, you know, vicious cycle would happen, and I'd be drunk again. And I was telling my doctor, he asked me how much I drank, and I thought, I was kind of offended. I'm thinking, none of your business, really. So I just said, a couple. And he goes, okay, well, here's some Maalox stuff. And he goes, so you might want to take a look at some of these pamphlets and help yourself. And he left the room, and he had the whole AA literature rack in that room, like he's ready for me, you know. I'd been there before for my stomach. And so So I looked at him, and I was going through the pamphlets, and I thought, to the woman alcoholic and too young, and they had the 20 questions, and I was thinking about taking some, and then I realized, because I'm so sharp, that he probably has 10 each of all those pamphlets, and after I leave, if I take some, they'll only be 9, and then he knows what I think I am, so I'm not taking any. So there you go. And so I left, and I fired him as my doctor, and I was like, I was offended by that. Anyway, and so I ended up going to the Alano Club. And Terry Engelman, I just found out that he passed away not too long ago, but he was a young guy at that time, and he was his secretary, and he had the book, and he was doing just what your secretary does, and it was everybody sat at one of these tables, and it was a book study, and it was the first time I had ever been to an AA meeting, and the first guy said, "I'm Fred, I'm an alcoholic," and I'm like, everybody goes, "Hi, Fred," and I'm chewing my cheek to keep from laughing. I'm thinking, "Oh, hi, Fred," like Fred doesn't know his name. Let's all yell, "Hi, Fred," and so anyway, I'm just like in my head with this Fred thing, and so they're going around the room, and I'm like not even paying attention to the message at all, and afterwards, Terry came up to me and he said, "You didn't say you were an alcoholic." And I said, "No, I just drink beer only." And then that little liar, you know, that little thing in your shoulder, it's like, you get drink anything, get your hands on. And I'm like, you know, listening to my head and then him. And he's smiling at me and I'm thinking, oh, I think he's hitting on me. But he was thinking chapter 3. But anyway, I said I was just there for intervention to go back to Ohio. And he said, "Well, why don't you take this meeting schedule, and here's my number, and give me a call when you get back, and let me know how that intervention goes." And I said I would, and I took that meeting schedule home, and when I got to my kitchen, I was looking at the back of it, and it said, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And it's like, I love that prayer. And I put it on my fridge, and I threw the meeting schedule in the drawer, and I went back to Ohio, and I went to all those classes like I had to, and I took all the tests, and I went to an AA meeting, and I went to an Al-Anon speaker meeting, and I had to meet with the counselor the day before we did this, and I'm like, oh, my God. And she goes, are you okay? And I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she goes, you may be, but we're only here for your mom. And I'm like, you got that. I'm like, she misunderstood that statement. I thought, and it isn't that I wanted to quit. I just realized I might have a problem. Anyway, and so we did that intervention for my mom. And it was really hard because we all told her how her drinking impacted us and how we wanted her to, you know, get help and be the mom we always wanted, but, you know, I didn't give a damn whether I might have been the daughter she would have wanted. You know, I didn't care. That selfish self-centeredness was that. That's all I wanted was her to buck up and be who I wanted. And I, afterwards, all my siblings went home with their spouses, and my dad and I went and got her clothes, and she agreed to stay 28 days, and we took her clothes and dropped them off, and we went to the Elks Club, and we just sat there and drank and drank and drank and drank. And it's like we talked about who I should pick in the football pool and how the weather was out here and all of that superficial stuff. And we never talked about what just happened and how we felt and how I felt like such a hypocrite and all that stuff. And it's like I just needed to drink even more to cover up those feelings. And it's like I came back out here and went back to my job and my same old life. And you guys had made a difference in my mom's life when she got out of there. She started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and she was playing golf again and fixing breakfast for my dad. And my mom was a really funny lady when she was, you know, in a good spot. And it was like, you guys gave me back my mom. And it was, she was a beautiful example of AA over the phone to me. I didn't know at that time that my grandpa had gotten sober back in 1946. That was my mom's dad, and I never knew that. I knew that side of the family didn't drink, and we wouldn't spend very much time with them. But anyway, love you, bye. We'd go to the other side, and they drank beer and brewed beer in the basement. They were a little more fun. But I didn't know. Nobody ever talked about my grandpa being in AA. Never knew about that. But my mom was doing good. And then after several months, she went back to drinking after foot surgery. And my grandpa died, her dad. And she never made it back here. You know, she just died a year and a half ago. And, you know, she didn't make it back. But because of me being sober and working the steps, I got to hopefully be the kind of daughter that she respected. And I showed up for things, and I called every week, and I acknowledged holidays. And, you know, we didn't get close, but I showed up for all the things that were important. And every time she got sick, I would go back, and I would be there and be a good daughter. And, you know, alcohol puts a wall around us, you know. And you brought my walls down, but it didn't change the wall around her. But you know what? I got to love her. And when she passed away, I got to be the one to do her eulogy because nobody else wanted to do it. And I got to give a nice tribute to my mom. And I'm clean inside. Not that I was, you know, a perfect daughter or anything like that, but I knew that I tried for all those years. And, you know, I got to live my amends. And that's what, you know, when I started doing my steps, and so let me back up a second. So when after we did this intervention and stuff, I came back and my alcoholism progressed even more. I got rid of that drug addict guy for the last time, and I moved in this little guest cottage, and it was up a steep driveway above the garage, and little tiny 500 square foot place with slanted ceilings and a little dollhouse up there. And the last 2 months of my drinking were in that place when I moved in, and I was so terrified that people were looking in the windows, you know, like tall people. Anyway, and so, because I'm upstairs and I'm thinking that they're like, you know, anyway. And so, you know, your mind doesn't get quite right when you drink too much. Anyway, so I'm like all paranoid about these people. And so I decided the smartest thing to do is to drink in the dark so they can't see you. And so I'm drinking in the dark and I'm smoking cigarettes at the time. And then I realized, just like my mom in the living room, when I take a drag off, then they can see me. And so so I decided the only safe place was on the kitchen floor. There you have it. They can't find me there. And so I was drinking on the kitchen floor, and I'm 25 years old and I'm so drunk. And I'm drunk on the kitchen floor, and I needed to throw up, and I couldn't hardly get up off the floor, and I'm hanging on to the drawer handles to pull me up and get around the counter and walk through the bedroom in this little tiny hall, and I'm falling sideways into the hall and I in the closet and stuff, and then I got in the bathroom and I fell sideways into the dry bathtub, and I could hardly get out. And it's like I was 25 years old, and alcoholism has taken me to the cleaners. And I just, you know, I made it out of there, and I was in and out of blackouts. I had a lot of blackouts, and I had gotten picked up for drunk driving right before I moved into that place. And so I was really paranoid about that, too, because I spent the night in jail, and if you make a scene, you get your own room. Anyway, just saying. And so I was in there, and that was terrifying to me. And they were really, really, really good to me. So I'm like, thank you to the sheriffs in North County for their kindness. And that didn't make me stop drinking, but it's like it made me paranoid to drive drunk. And so I had to try and get enough alcohol when I got home from work so that I knew that I would not pace myself, you know what I mean? And so I had to make sure I had enough so I wouldn't get another DUI. And it's like I was dying of alcoholism, and it's like I didn't know what to do. And I came to, and in and out of blackouts, I had called that old IV drug user, and there he was in my place. And I barely remember even calling him, except for I remember fighting about why he missed my birthday yet again 3 years ago. Anyway, and so we were fighting, and then all of a sudden there he is, and I'm coming out of a blackout, and I told him to leave, and the sun's coming up, and I'm crying and throwing up, and came out to my dining room, and I had a great view from up there over the hills of Vista. And I'm looking out the window, and I'm crying, and I'm trying to drink coffee, and my hands are shaking, and I'm sobbing, and I just said, God, help me. And he came to me that instant. And it's like, you know, my mom taught me that now I lay me down to sleep when I was a little kid. And my mom gave us a God as you understand him. And it wasn't till years in this program that I realized that, because she grew up in a house with a dad in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was raised with a God as she understood him. And she gave us open-ended, you know, belief. And but she taught us that there's somebody, an unseen friend for us to reach out to. And so when I said, God, help me, somebody picked me up from under my arms, and I was in the chair, and my shoulders went up, and I was just hoisted up out of the chair, and I went over to the kitchen counter, and it was like I wasn't scared. My mind was completely quiet, and I watched my hand open the phone book, and I didn't even know, for you young people, it's a book that has phone numbers in it. Anyway, and so my phone was on the wall too. Anyway, and so I watched my hands out of my eyeballs, I watched my hands open the pages, and I had no idea on what my hands were doing. And I wasn't scared. My mind was completely quiet, which it never was. And my finger stopped at the Alano Club, and I thought, I know what that is. That's where that AA meeting was. So I just dialed the number, and Judy answered, and Judy was this little tiny petite lady, and she ran the coffee bar at the Oceanside Alano Club. And they had long tables like this, and Judy ran up and down the aisles with regular and decaf, you know, like one of those little sandpiper birds, you know. She's like, pouring coffee. Anyway, so Judy answered. She goes, hi, I'm Judy. I'm a happy alcoholic. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like, my head was like, wow, you know, and I'm like, oh, tone it down, Judy. And I go, you know what? Will you help me? And she said, yes. And she said, can you come to a meeting right now? And I'm so grateful that she didn't say, if you leave Vista right now, you're going to miss half the afternoon meeting. Come tonight. She said, come right now. And it's like, you know, the big book says in the back, right before the traditions, it says, to those now in its fold, Alcoholics Anonymous has made the difference between misery and sobriety, and often the difference between life and death. It's to those now in its fold, in the fold, right in the middle. And she pulled me right into the middle. You know, when I got out there, because I said, I'll come out there right now. And she waited at the door for me. And it's like, that's love, you know. She met me at the door. She took me in. We sat down and the last half of the meeting. I don't remember anything that was said. It was like Charlie Brown's mom talking, wah, 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 you know. I didn't get anything except the lady next to me was knitting, and there were big needles. I'm like, clackety, clackety. I'm like looking at her. Anyway, and so afterwards, she gave me her phone number on a little piece of paper and said, if you'd like, give me a call later and you can come over to my house if you're not comfortable. And I'm thinking, why would I not be comfortable? I've lived there 2 months, you know. But anyway, I didn't say any of that. I'm just in my head, you know. And then I went home after that meeting and I paced around that little tiny place like a caged animal. I didn't know how to not drink, you know. And she said, I called her and she said, can you come over right now? And I did. And she 12-stepped me. And you know, Judy, before I left the Alano Club, wrote H-A-L-T on a napkin. She said, don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Those are things to watch for. And she said to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and to get a sponsor and start reading the big book. And all these things, I started filling up my toolbox with all these things that people were telling me. And Jody, or Darlene 12-stepped me that day, and she sponsored me for about a month, and then, you know, she ended up not really even going to meetings, but I got another sponsor, and over the years, I've had different sponsors, and each have added something that has kept me in these rooms and kept me sober and added to the quality of my relationship with God. And so I started on my way, and I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. In fact, I did that for over a year. And I got commitments at the meeting, and I started working my steps. And, you know, my home group it's 200 and some people. And back then it was over 300, and it was like I was coming off my kitchen floor and then go, bless you. And I would go to that meeting, and it was so loud and so many people. And part of me, there was tons of greeters, and I loved the attention and the hugs and all that stuff. And yet I was terrified of it. And it was the very first thing that I ever admitted to my sponsor was that I was afraid of people. Cliff Roach used to tease me all the time. He said, you know, you were so broken when you got here. He goes, if we touched you, you flinched, and you wouldn't look anybody in the eye. You only knew us by our shoes. And it was like, you know, I was broken, you know. This disease had taken me to the cleaners, and And so I admitted to my sponsor that I was afraid of people. And she goes, oh, you are? Oh, good. You can be a greeter. Off to the door. And I'm like, oh, my God. She's not listening to me. I said, I'm afraid of people, you know. And so, but the thing that was so beautiful about that was that she taught me about taking actions opposite of how I felt. And if I would have waited until I was comfortable around people, I wouldn't be at this podium today, because I was taught to do things that made me uncomfortable until I was comfortable in my skin. And what getting to the meeting 45 minutes early and getting to know just the other greeters and making people feel welcome when they came in, all of a sudden it was like, oh, welcome to my meeting. All of a sudden, I was not being a taker like I had been my whole life. I was giving back in some little way. All of a sudden, instead of your meeting, it was my meeting too. And I got that feeling by giving back and taking commitments, just like Tom and so many of you do, and all the ways that you serve this awesome facility. You know, so I started on my way with commitments, and I still do commitments to this day. And I've worked my steps, and, you know, I wasn't sure. I knew there was a God or an angel. Somebody lifted me up and led me to you. And it's like, and I never forgot that. You know what I mean? But then I was so afraid, like, of step three. I knew I was an alcoholic and my life was unmanageable. At first, I thought that meant that you didn't have a job, because I heard what you said. You didn't have a job. You didn't have a husband. You lost your house, all that. I never had any of those things anyway except the job. And so I kept the job, but it was like my unmanageability was all the stuff on the inside, my emotions and how I coped with life or didn't, and all of that kind of stuff, and riddled with fear and resentments. And so once I understood that, I really knew about step one and two. And then turning my will and my life over to God, I thought that it was kind of like a Billy Graham thing. And if I didn't do it right, I wouldn't get to stay here, because I loved you guys already. And I knew this is where I belonged. All of a sudden, I found out that really is what my problem is alcoholism, that spiritual malady and that, you know, phenomenon of craving. And all the ways you explain that disease to me and the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. It's like, man, that I understood that part. You're starting on the fishing boat. Anyway, and so I related and I knew this is where I belonged. And it's like, but when I did step three with my sponsor, we did the prayer together. I read it and then she read it out loud and then we read it together. But the thing that was good for me was in the 12 and 12 where it talked about all you need is a key of willingness, even though self-will will slam that door shut again. You just need the key of willingness. And she said, what's more important is to get busy doing your fourth step. And so I did that, and I wasn't reading the book much at that time. And the sponsor I had, I wasn't really a real big book person like I ended up with later on. And so I didn't realize, you know, about the columns and all that stuff. I was just told to write out your life story and start with the things you swore you'd never tell anybody, and then to write your resentments and your fears and your sexual misconduct, which that's part of it. But anyway, I did that, but I didn't do the column like my part. How did I set the ball rolling? But, you know, I did enough to start giving me some relief and to be able to do step 6 and 7. And, you know, more so lately, I've been really mindful of step 7. I just have kind of, for a while, just glossed over that. I knew my shortcomings at work. I was like a persnickety little hall monitor with my coworker who would never show up on time. And I'm like keeping track, like to me, right? Like, I'm not his supervisor, but I'm like, what the hell? 20 after, you know? And it's like, you know, I'm just so caught up in all that other kind of petty crap. And it's like, when I really started being mindful of step 7 and asking God to relieve me of the defects that block me from being a service to him. And what I would talk to my sponsor about is like, I want to be a good example of this program. And that kind of behavior is not being a good example. And it's like, I got relief from that. And I was telling her lately, it's like, you know, when I check in weekly with her, it's like, it's so neat to me how even after 34 years, I'm still in awe of how God and this program work. When I do that 7-step prayer and I ask God to relieve me of those things, and all of a sudden I realize, when did that, he answered that, it's gone. And it's like, and I'm just like, I can just be kind to this man, and you know, there's no tension anymore. And it's like, it's working step 7. And, you know, I did my amends list the very first time, and I was taught that, you know, that's where the promises come in. You start getting the relief by making things right with people. And I made my direct amends to some people, and I had to pay back money and all that kind of stuff. I had stolen money from this ice cream place I worked at in Ohio. And I, the sponsor that I first did my steps with told me to pay it back anonymously to charity, and I did that. And years later, Dr. Paul was my sponsor then, and I said, you know, every time I hear somebody at a podium or in a book study talk about paying back the money to who they took it from, I don't feel clean inside. I said, I did it. I paid it back with interest to charity like my sponsor had me do. And I said, but I didn't give it back to who I took it from. And he said, well, let's redo that amends. And so I was making more money at that time, but even if I didn't, I got that money together. I went back to Ohio and called from a phone booth. You know, those were things where there was a little phone in a building. Anyway, and so I went to one of those and called him. It had been a long time since I worked for him. And I asked if his wife remembered me, and she said, yeah. And I said I needed to talk to her and her husband. She goes, come over to our house right now. And I did that, and I got to give him the envelope of money and told him that I was in AA and that I was making right the wrong, and that I didn't know if they knew I had stolen money from their cash register, but I was here to pay it back with interest and inflation. And he goes, oh, Deb, the 60s and 70s were rough on everybody. He was so nice to me and just let me off the hook, you know. And he goes, you don't have to pay me back. And I said, it's not my money, it's yours, and just left the envelope. And we, you know, we write Christmas cards back and forth now, and we're clean. And when I left that day, it was like I felt like I was 2 feet off the ground, you know. I knew now, and anytime anybody talks about financial amends, I'm clean inside. You know, we'll intuitively know how to handle situations, you know, with our sponsor's help. And so anyway, and so I made direct amends to my family and then living amends. And like I said, I'm just now with one sister, you know, starting to build a relationship again. After my mom died and my dad died 8 years ago, our family was just kind of shattered. And it's like, I grieved. I was just telling Joan, I feel like I'm just coming out of the grief of that, because I never got married and I don't have kids. And it's like, to have all my family kind of go out of my life at the same time too, it was a lot. And it's like, but you know what? You're my family, you know? And it's like, I want to be a good example to them. They're all drinkers and a little bit of Xanax on the side. Anyway, and so you're my Xanax. You guys are how I cope with stuff, and how I handle grief is by walking through it and helping other people walk through their grief. I had a list when I got sober. My home group is a speaker meeting, and this one speaker, and pretty early in sobriety, she said if she would have made a list of everything she wanted in sobriety, she would have shortchanged herself. And I thought, she's not much of a list maker then, is she? And so I went home and I made my list, and I wrote I wanted a husband and 6 kids, and I wanted to go to Europe and Alaska, and I wanted to pass the LSIT and LS exams to be a licensed land surveyor and get my degree in surveying and buy a house. And it's like, you know, I thought that was a big list, and I still have that little list really in my big book. And what happened is over the years, I've only got a couple of things that were on that list. But after some time, I realized that every single thing on that list was something on the outside. You know, and the promises, I wasn't real thrilled with those when I was new. It's like, oh, we'll comprehend serenity and we'll know peace. I'm like, wee-wee, how about a husband? Anyway, and so that's not much. Anyway, and so now I know that those are priceless things, because all of those promises are things that are on the inside that I get from working the steps, and that nobody can take those away. You know, I've lost jobs in sobriety. I got sick. I got really sick. I was going to go to Europe, and I went to England at 7 years of sobriety because, you know, he wasn't coming along, and that was on one of the things on my list. And I decided I'm going to go on my own, and I decided I'm just going to go do it a day at a time, just like you guys taught me. So I got my ticket, and it was, you know, several months out, and this lady from my home group said, you're going to Europe by yourself? She goes, oh my God, Deb, there's pickpockets over there. And I mean this, I was not afraid until then. Now I'm afraid, right? And so then I go to my Monday book study not long after that, and this guy shows up, Brian, and he passed away several years ago, but he was in his 70s then, and he was from Bristol, England, and very proper English man. And I became pen pals with him because I said I was going to be coming to England in a few months. And then I wrote him, and I didn't say about the pickpocket. I thought that'd be offensive. But I said, I'm a little bit afraid traveling alone in England. And he wrote me back. He said, Deb, God lives this side of the pond. And he said, if you'd like, I'd like to meet you your third day in London and go to a meeting. And would you speak at my home group in Bristol on your last night? And it was like I had 2 AA commitments in a country I hadn't been to, and I was all shored up, you know. And I got the international directory, so I knew where the meetings were in London anyway. So I went there, and on my first day, I did what you guys taught me. Get to the meeting early and see how you can give back. And I'm a tea drinker, and when I got there, this meeting, the girls were making these big pots of tea in the kitchen, so I was loving it anyway. So I'm making tea and talking with these girls, and they were super nice. And all of a sudden, it was time for the meeting, and the church is filling up. And I went back, and I got my seat, and everybody's packed in. And all of a sudden, this lady goes, psst, psst, Deb, Deb. And I look at the end of the aisle, and she's like, come here, come here, come here. And I'm like, excuse me, pardon me. And I go over, and she goes, oh, mind your wallet, love. The man next to you is a pickpocket. I'm like, oh, what the hell? I'm like, okay. I went back, I sat down, and I shook his hand. And I was like, my eyes all welled up because I got to say hi to him and welcome him, because he was clearly a homeless man. And it was like, you know, I thought, I should have known he'd be here. Anyway, but, you know, she was looking out for me to take care of me, and I could welcome him because that's what you did to me. I may have stolen from the ice cream place and not been homeless, but I was a thief, and so was he. And I knew that if he stayed here, if we gave him a warm welcome, and if he stayed, he wouldn't be a thief anymore either. And it was so cool. I'm like, geez, 11 hours, and there I am finding him. And so I went ahead and I went all over England and Scotland, and I drove on the other side of the road. I thought, oh my God, I was driving, shifting with my left hand, and it's like, here's what happens in high school when the person's rolling a joint and they're driving a stick shift, you shift for them. So now I know in Europe how to drive on the other side. There you go. Nothing's ever wasted. And so anyway, so I just went to New Zealand. I thought, I got this. Anyway, and so I just went all over, and I was crying on that trip. And it was, I was by myself out in the middle of nowhere except sheep in the road, blasting Phantom of the Opera, because I got to see that. And I was crying because I knew that I was by myself, but I knew I wasn't alone. I had tapped an unsuspected inner resource, and I found the great reality deep within. And I found it, and I was more mindful of it when I was on the other side of the world from here, because all of a sudden I didn't have all of you in my meetings and my work and my home and all that. I knew I was completely separated, and that everything that I felt comfortable with had come from the inside. That's where that reality was. And it's like, and I got to go back, 2 years later I decided to go to Germany, because I lived there when I was a little kid, and I got sick right before I went and passed out on the floor twice in that little guest cottage, and went to the doctor and found out that I was anemic, and he said, be careful on this trip, and when you come back, we'll recheck you. And I didn't feel good, and I got in a car accident over there, and it was a rough trip, even though it was beautiful. I got to see my kindergarten girlfriend. We're still in touch and all that. But when I came back, he tested me, and he goes, the anemia is gone, but you have a rare autoimmune blood disease. And it's like, you know, I struggled with that for 11 years. In fact, I remember coming here when I was all jacked up on steroids and just sobbing, because I was allowing my faith to go up and down with my platelet counts is what it was. And I didn't even realize that. I was so like, you know, God, please give me platelets this week. And it's like, and then if the numbers went down, I allowed my faith to go down. And if they went up, you know, and I was a mess. And all of a sudden I got to a point where I just hit this surrender on another level. And I just said, I got on my knees and I'm like, whatever the counts are today, thank you, good or bad. If they went down, I got on my knees and I thanked him for them going down and going up. And then I ended up getting my spleen out, and it worked for me, and I was well for 5 years. And then I went through a bunch of stress at my job working for somebody that was threatening me, and it was a bad situation. And anyway, and then I grew another spleen. How about that? Anyway, my sponsor then said, oh, maybe you could sell them on Craigslist. You can thank Paul C. for that compassion. Anyway, and so anyway, I went through another surgery, and I've been well ever since, and I really feel like it's gone for good now, you know. But it's like, I was so anxiety ridden. Part of it was the steroids and the self-centered fear. And I was up at like 4 a.m. one day, and I called a friend, and I couldn't stop sobbing. I was just like, just anxiety attack. And I said, if this is what I'm like in my 40s, what am I gonna be like in my 50s? You know, just like. And he goes, well, you'll be all right for the rest of today, won't you? And I quieted right down. I forgot to live one day at a time. I forgot to practice that principle in all my affairs. And you know, it's like, I have a really, really good life today. I've got a job. I'd really like to retire, but I'm getting close. I'm like a horse running into the barn now. You know, I told a coworker, I said, my mouth is getting looser as I get closer. I said, I hope I don't say something to one of these customers. I'd just fry my butt. Anyway, but I want to keep my job. But anyway, I never like to end without telling you a story about my grandpa, because we just stay sober and these miracles happen. Sometimes they're profound, sometimes they're not. But I found out when I had 7 years of sobriety, whatever was going on at that time, my mom and I were talking about alcoholism. And I said, Mom, you and I are the only alcoholics in the family. And she said, well, no, we're not. Grandpa was in AA. And I never knew that. That was her dad. And I found out that he had gotten sober in 1946 back in Michigan. And my grandma was still alive for many years after that. She died when she was 95. And I got to be the opening speaker at the South Bay Roundup in 2000. And it was such an honor. And there's like 3,000 people there. And it's this wild, insane conference.
and I'm the opening speaker. And out of all of those people, the person leading the meeting, Roger Daniels, was he had gotten sober. He and his wife got sober in Torrance area, and they lived in New Mexico, but they came back every year for that conference. And Roger is leading the meeting, and I just shared what I did with you. You know, my grandpa got sober in 1946 in Michigan, and I never got to share this program with him. I don't know if he's the one who lifted me out of my chair. I don't know how that works on the in the fourth dimension, but somebody did that led me to you. And Roger, after that meeting, he said, I want to talk to you this weekend about your grandpa, because my uncle got sober in Michigan around that same time. Maybe they knew each other. And in my head, I'm thinking, are you kidding me? The mitten's big. You know, I'm sure they knew each other. You know, I'm such a skeptic. But I said, oh, sure, I'd love to talk to you. Anyway, so the next night, Roger came up to me and he said, well, he goes, what town was your grandpa from? And I said, it's this little tiny town outside of Jackson, Michigan. It's called Vandercook Lake. And he goes, that's the town my uncle's from. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I said, my grandma's still alive. And he goes, call your grandma and ask her if she remembers my uncle. And I go, well, what was his name? And he goes, Roy Drinkwine. Isn't that the best AA name? I swear to God. I'm like, my nickname in high school was Doobie. So I thought, I want to be Doobie Drink Beer. Anyway, and so when I got home from the conference, I called my grandma, and she had had heart surgery and all this stuff. And I'm like, sorry about your heart, Grandma, by the way. I go, do you remember a man by the name of Roy Drinkwine? And she didn't miss a beat. And she goes, well, yeah, Deb. She goes, Roy Drinkwine. She goes, when Grandpa's, bless you, when Grandpa's drinking got so bad that I had to throw him out of the house, she said, Roy Drinkwine was the man who carried the AA message to your grandpa. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's so cool. Love you, bye. Click. I'm like, I dial Roger and Annie in New Mexico, and they're both on the phone. And I said, we're related. And we just all were sobbing on the phone. And it's like, you know, those little God shots. And my grandma gave me his first edition big book and the original little red book and all those kind of things. And it's like I carry him in my heart. You know, I wish he was alive. And I wish there was somebody in my family, you know, to share this beautiful design for living with. But maybe someday, you know, last November, one of my nephews committed suicide. And it's like, you know, this disease plays for keeps. And it's like, you know, we get to keep each other here. You know, we got to be good to one another. Thank you.
Debbie from Vista, that was great. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. One more time for Debbie. Thank you to the women and the residents of the house for a great dinner tonight. Let's circle up.